Okay, thanks very much for the introduction. What I want to do, as the title might suggest, is to talk about the way that, to some degree, Keynes analysed competition and money in the general theory, but not perhaps so much specifically the details of what he was saying, but the sort of implications of the approach that was taken there, and also to some extent the approach, the implications for later macroeconomic analysis. Now, some parts along the way, I'll be also comparing Keynes's approach with that of Kolesky, but the main emphasis is going to be very much on Keynes, with minor reference to Kolesky, in effect. Oops. Now, also, looking at competition and money in Keynes' general theory, but to some extent has raised with me at least a couple of puzzles, which is partly why did Keynes use the something close to perfect competition in the general theory, writing in Cambridge, of course, at the time when Joan Robinson was writing Imperfect Competition, and others were working on in that sort of area. And also to look at what the, I suppose, the implications of that assumption about perfect competition were for the way he then analysed macroeconomics. And in a sense, similarly, how Keynes came to assume something which I'll call just close to exogenous money, when, in a sense, in the treatise, he had analysed credit money, and why that, to some extent, that kind of switch took place. And the link, of course, with Kolesky is that Kolesky took different views in both of these sort of areas. In the case of competition, Kolesky became known for having the ideas about degree market power and the degree of monopoly and in terms of pricing behaviour. Although it should be said that Kolesky's own initial ideas on the role of effective demand really were done against in the background of perfect competition of some form. And also in Kolesky, usually tucked away in footnotes, there was the idea that money was effectively bank money, and that banks had this controlling position, as it were, in the sense of the banks had to decide whether they were going to grant loans to people, and it was only if those loans were granted that investment could take place, or at least investment could expand and take place. But in the case of money, Kolesky, as I say, sort of tended to bury this away in footnotes, and it was a kind of assumption there in the background which he didn't make a great deal of. Now, although you may not see particularly the significance of this, but because this really relates back to some debates which went back on in the 1980s. The argument here is not that imperfect competition is required to provide an explanation of unemployment. So the argument is that, in a sense, unemployment is to be viewed essentially in terms of a lack of aggregate demand, and that the particular structure of competition does not in itself interact with that assumption. Exactly what effects aggregate demand changes have does depend upon the structure of competition, exactly how prices respond and so forth to a change in demand does depend upon the nature of competition, but as providing an explanation for unemployment, we don't need imperfect competition rather than perfect competition. Although I think looking at imperfect competition rather than perfect competition does help to explain capacity underutilization. Now, quite often there's almost like a mapping from unemployment to excess capacity. But I would see, in a sense, the explanations of those as being to some extent different. whilst it may well be that the level of unemployment and the extent of capacity utilisation does fluctuate over the business cycle, there may well be changes in the relationship between unemployment and the degree of excess capacity. But I would see the role of imperfect competition in this sort of regard as related to the explanation, or some partial explanation, of capacity underutilisation rather than unemployment. Now, I think there's one argument which a number of people put, which is to the effect that one of the reasons for, in a sense, using perfect competition on the one hand and using exogenous money on the other was that, in a sense, this was in order to kind of, well, I would describe here as take on the neoclassicals, that is, to take the assumptions which they make and then show that by some sort of tweak, as it were, of the in the analysis, we come to different results, even though the assumptions to do with perfect competition and money are the same as being used in the classical or neoclassical analysis. Now, I think this argument has often been put forward. Again, I think it's essentially kind of spurious argument, in the sense that one would not usually want to go about an analysis on the grounds of saying, well, I'm going to take somebody else's assumptions and just, even if I think those assumptions are not realistic in some sense, or reasonable, or whatever phrase one wants to use. But I think also there is an argument for using some notions of imperfect competition, whether it's monopolistic competition, models of oligopoly or whatever, but some general notions of imperfect competition, partly on the grounds of kind of realism, in the sense that my observation about the real world is that it is formed by some degree of competition amongst firms who produce heterogeneous products, there's product innovation and so forth, and so that perfect competition, at least understood in the sense of homogeneous products, is a very limited applicability, if at all, whereas imperfect competition, with this very broad definition that I would use of the notion of imperfect competition, does have this sort of striking of realism to my mind about it. Now, one of the other kind of, I suppose, almost like puzzles really relates to the observation which is up now on the overhead, which is that I think Kahn, in his thesis, pointed out that firms under perfect competition operate where marginal cost is rising and where marginal cost is above average variable costs. But of course, under imperfect competition, firms would often operate where average costs are declining, and that was the 1933, the Chamberlain type of result under monopolistic competition. But what also I think Kahn went on to point out was I think it was partly a study of the UK textile industry, if I remember rightly, was that what we observe in a downturn is that while some firms close down, most firms will continue in being but operate with with spare capacity. So whereas if we had a regime of perfect competition, we would observe that firms would either close down, or if they remain in operation, would have to operate where marginal cost was above average variable costs, which, with the definition that's used of what constitutes capacity, would mean that firms would be observed to be operating above capacity or not operating at all. Whereas we observe that whilst some firms do close down in a recession, firms do operate with below capacity utilisation. So that kind of general lack of correspondence with what we observe in an actual recession with what would come out of these respective theories in terms of perfect competition and imperfect competition. Oops, I think the one of the, to my mind, kind of advantages of using imperfect competition is, and there was of course a big literature around at the time in the 1930s, not concerned with things like administered pricing, is that in some sense it forces to take some view about how prices are actually formulated. How do firms go about deciding prices, even if we do it in a very abstract way and based on profit maximisation or whatever else? We have, in a sense, or the analysis has to confront how prices are ever formed. Whereas under perfect competition, there's always this problem, which I suppose Clara and Lyon Hubbard and others pointed, or are following Arrow as well, is which is how, when all firms are price takers, are how are prices formed. So there's always a lack of a process of the way in which prices adjust. I think also, in I was saying, in the general theory, there's a sense in which price is equal to marginal cost. And I want to draw out two implications of that type of view. One is, of course, if we flip it over, then we get the result marginal, the real wage is equal to the marginal product of labour, which I suppose has been one of the most misinterpreted relationships that Keynes put forward, in the sense that having real wage equal to the marginal product of labour, people say, aha, that's a demand for labour curve, where with the real wage set governing, as it were, what labour firms employ, whereas we know really the interpretation is the other way around, that that given the level of effective demand, then that indicates the amount of employment there is, and at that level of employment, then price equal to marginal cost will give the relationship real wage equal to the marginal product of labour. So in a sense, whilst I think that's an kind of important result, that issue about the direction of causation was often became misinterpreted afterwards. The second aspect of this, I would say, is that firms, in a sense, satisfy the demand which they face. It is given the level of effective demand, firms adjust price equal to marginal cost, and in that sense, they are willingly supplying what is demanded of them at this price which has been set. Now, I think I take both of those, the idea of the level of effective demand influences the marginal, or sets the marginal product of labour, which is then equal to the real wage, and the idea that firms satisfy the demand which they face, as important aspects, which both of which in the subsequent macroeconomic analysis was sort of largely either misinterpreted or forgotten. Now, what the argument is that, in a sense, using imperfect competition would have led to these similar sort of results, but done so in a easier manner, and one which would be more kind of firmly based and firmly established. So that I would say, firstly, that firms making price decisions which the second line there may not read very well, but it's firms making pricing decisions which influence the relationship between wage and own price, i.e. the real product wage. I think that idea that the way in which prices are determined, are set, then influences the real product wage, and the idea, in a sense, which could be associated with that, that the real product wage is at least strongly influenced, if not determined, in the product market, is I often see as a kind of particularly important sort of implication. Because once you have that idea, then any notion that the real wage is in some sense set at the wrong level, whatever you mean by that, well, if it is, then it's to do with the pricing decision. So the real wage might be at the kind of wrong level, whatever we mean by that, because firms are charging too high a price, or too low a price for that matter. But it's, so it gets in a way away from this idea that it is labour in setting the money wage which is then determining the real wage. And hence the idea that somehow if the real wage is too high, it's because workers are being pushing for too high wages, and puts it the other way around, in a sense, and says that the real wage is really to do with firms' pricing decisions. Secondly, I think one should interpret imperfect competition as that firms set price and then satisfy demand at that price. If you think about any kind of standard microeconomics, or you know, whether it's theory of monopoly, theory of oligopoly, theory of monopolistic competition, whatever it is, and you put it in these terms, well, what it is the firm decides, or at least we often portray it, that firms decide price, which is in their interests, and then they set the price, and then they will supply whatever is demanded at that price. So there's a sense in which firms are intending, at least, to satisfy the demand at that's forthcoming at the price which they've set. Now, it's a little bit difficult to translate this into excess demand and excess supply, because excess demand and supply rely upon the idea that demand is a function only of price and supply is a function of price, where the price is some sort of market given. Whereas here, of course, price is being set by the firm itself. But I think one could interpret theories of imperfect competition as saying that firms are seeking to satisfy the demand which they face at the price which they set. Now, I think that becomes more clear-cut if we think of theories like full-cost pricing and so forth. All of those are very much on the idea that, well, the firm will set the price and then supply whatever is ever demanded at that price. But if you think about theories of monopoly, for example, to take it as a simple example, then again firms are setting a price or picking a price from along the demand curve which they face and want to pick, as it were, the price and quantity combination which is in their best interest, but in effect are going to be supplying the demand which is forthcoming at that. Now, one of the implications I draw out of that is, in effect, my talents of putting algebra into PowerPoint are not very great. So, consequently, I can't get in suffixes and subscripts and so on. But all the idea is that, if you take households, then their demand for consumer goods is QDC. And they have savings, intended savings of SA, LS is labour supply, and PI is profits. Firms' profits are equal to the quantity they supply minus labour demanded. And I kind of put those together, and the equation which I get down at the bottom really is the idea that, after all, if firms are operating in a way such that the price is set so that the demand for output is going to be equal to the supply of output, then it just follows quite quickly that there's this link between the labour market excess supply and the difference between intended savings and an investment demand. Now, I partly would want to contrast that with the views which, again, was implicit in the, or not implicit, in the reappraisal of Keynesian economics literature, that it was to do with markets not clearing and the consequences of that, whereas I would argue here that actually this is an idea that the product market does clear, and then that leaves us this relationship between unemployment in terms of the excess supply of labour and the savings investment decision. Now, in terms of the argument about Keynes's approach, partly I want to argue that this type of idea, this link between unemployment and savings investment decision, is a kind of key relationship. But the other line I want to argue really is that, in a sense, this would follow more easily and more readily from assuming imperfect competition rather than perfect competition. Now, you might say, well, that's not a good reason to assume imperfect competition just because it makes the analysis a bit easier. But I would argue that one should use ideas of imperfect competition anyway because of realism or whatever you want to call it, but it would have this sort of consequence for the type of analysis or the presentation of the analysis afterwards. Now, I think a number of other reasons, in a sense, for moving away from perfect competition are the four that I've listed there. Or The first is, I think if one has a view of imperfect competition, then there's a sense in which there's not a demand for labour function. And in the following sense, if you say, what is a demand for labour function? Well, the demand for labour is the idea of what is the quantity of labour which a firm would want to demand given the real wage, the real product wage which they face. But of course, the way that the demand for labour, the demand for labour function is portrayed, is the idea that the firm faces a exogenously given real product wage, and it then adjusts its employment according to that. Now, I would say, and I'm not going to go into the argument here, but I would say that in a sense, under imperfect competition, because the firm is settling the relationship between the money wage and the price which it charges, it is settling its own real product wage. So it doesn't make it a great deal of sense to talk about that the relationship we derive from that as being a demand for labour function. Now, we want to link this over with the idea that we should try, or I think Keynes was moving away from, and others would want to move away from, any notion there is a labour market in the sense of interaction between demand and supply, in the sense that I'm arguing here, we don't really have a demand for labour function. So the way that the wage is settled is not in the, or the real wage is settled, is not again in the labour market in any sense, but it is done somewhere else. So it amongst other reasons, these are make it difficult to talk about any notion of a labour market. Secondly, and this relates to one of the issues that Keynes faced after the general theory in his interchange with Dunlop and Tarshish, was about how do real wages move over the course of the business cycle. There was the idea that in reality, as it were, or in the statistics, if that's reality, that real wages either didn't move very much over the course of the business cycle, or there may be kind of pro-cyclical variations in the sense of when demand rises, the real wage may rise. Whereas clearly under perfect competition, the demand curve for labour slopes downwards, and so one would predict from that, or not so much just the demand for labour, but even in the relationship between the marginal product of labour and the real product wage, that over the course of the business cycle, when employment was high, the real wage would be relatively low. And the evidence presented by Dunlop and Tarshi seemed to run counter to that, and then Keynes was then sought to try to kind of see what the implications were. But I think, again, imperfect competition, again, fits in much more readily with the idea that there may not be any particular relationship between real wages and employment over the course of the business cycle. The third aspect, and which is the kind of optimistic side of it, it would mean that if aggregate demand is increased, then under perfect competition type of assumptions, the idea is that in order for that real demand to come into effect, that's then going to be associated with lower real wages, whereas the imperfect competition view is that it may go one way or the other. Then in terms of this, what I'm saying here, I'm also saying that we may want to fit in a relationship between real wages and the level of aggregate demand in terms of the effects which changes in the distribution of income have upon the level of demand. And again, if we've then got a theory of imperfect competition, we've got some ideas about how the distribution between income may vary over the course of the cycle. Does that one go down? No. Right. Okay. Well, that's kind of a fairly quick run through. So just to kind of summarise the argument, really, is that there are features in the way we set up imperfect competition which would have kind of fitted in better more readily with the aggregate demand type of analysis, without it being required for an explanation of unemployment. So that, for example, to give another example of that sort of argument, if you think about, again, very standard models of imperfect competition, we draw a downward sloping demand curve facing the firm. Now, something has to kind of position that demand curve, and we might typically write down, the demand facing a particular firm depends upon prices charged by other firms. But I think we'd also want to write down that the level of the demand facing a firm depends also upon the overall level of demand, i.e. the level of aggregate demand. And so it's quite kind of easy, as it were, just to shift the demand curve in and out as the level of aggregate demand changes. One of the complications seems to me to arise under perfect competition is that, so far as the firm is concerned, well, if there's an increase in demand, well, at the industry level, prices rise, but so far as the firm is concerned, it's faced with a upward or downward shift, or upward shift with demand, in terms of the horizontal demand curve facing facing the firm. So there's a kind of confusion, or at least a possible confusion, between changes in aggregate demand and changes in price, because the way that the change in aggregate demand is represented is in terms of a change in price facing the firm. So that I think quite often in some of the more mainstream literature, there's that sort of confusion that, where do different changes in price come from? Well, they just come out of the air rather than coming from changes in aggregate demand. Now, let me, I think I shall rush on and talk about money. I want to and this is perhaps where I will make some more comparisons between Keynes and Kolesky. Now, there's been, I suppose, some debates over whether Keynes could be said to assume exogenous money in the sense of money given by the state, or the volume given by the central bank or whatever, or did he assume a constant stock of money in the sense that, well, okay, for the purpose of this analysis, we will treat the stock of money as constant, but there'll be another period coming along when the stock of money will be different, but we're really concerned with looking at the position with there being a constant stock of money. Given stock of money. I think one of the problems which then arise, if we treat it as just a given stock of money, even if we treat that the banks have created that amount of money, it doesn't take into account, or this, it makes it more difficult to deal with issues to do with how are the movements between different equilibria positions. How is investment, or the expansion of investment, I should say, financed? So whilst one can, to some extent, fit it in, perhaps, if there is a given stock of money, it doesn't easily lend itself. And I think there are parts in Keynes which could be treated as much closer to the idea of exogenous money, that is money which is the volume of which is changed by the central bank rather than by the banking system. And I want to illustrate that, I hope, in a moment. So the basis of the argument here really is that the problem of assuming a given or exogenous money is that not that easy to explain how would investment increase. For example, if there was the intention by firms to increase investment, given there's a prior amount of savings and savings will only increase after the investment has taken place, how does the investment get financed in the first place? Now, to my mind, and perhaps many others, the obvious answer is, well, investment that expansion in investment is financed by bank loans, and then those loans create money, money circulates, and so forth. So, again, assuming or treating money as endogenously created by the banking system, is almost a I better not use the term natural here, but a kind of partner with the relationship between investment and savings, where investment is the active agent and operates prior to the generation of savings, simply because it enables an explanation to be given of how investment is financed. Now, I would say that, because in papers in 37, to some extent, with the finance motive and so forth, that Keynes tried to kind of grapple with this, but it would have been much easier, as it were, if one had assumed this sort of credit money situation. And I think Keynesian economics, which probably has very little relationship to Keynes, but Keynesian economics of the ISLM type of variety in the 1960s and 1970s, again, never really answered the issue about, well, if the IS curve, as it were, shifts because investment, let's say, is increased, how does the economy move from one equilibrium position to another? Because if endogenous money had been incorporated in it, it would have been given that sort of explanation. Now, I think also, and this is taking me a little bit aside, I think at least in retrospect, if endogenous money, credit money, had been assumed, it might have saved us from a considerable amount of grief later on. And one which I wasn't going to mention, but I will here, which is the relationship between money and inflation. I suppose if the ideas of endogenous money had been clearly established, then we might not have ever had the monetarism in terms of controlling the money supply to control inflation. And it took Calder and many others years to re-establish the endogenous money and the lack of a causal link from money supply to inflation. And if only that had been kind of established in the general theory, then that type of grief might have been avoided. But the other area where we would have avoided some grief, as it were, is that as Kolesky did point out in 1944, I wish I could write papers which were as brief as his, which I think that was a 3-page paper, that notions of the real balance effect and the Pigou effect in terms of the effect of the real balance on consumption would have hopefully been largely avoided, in the sense that once we introduce the notion of endogenous credit money, then endogenous credit money has no net worth, so falls in the price level do not increase the real values of the block of financial assets, that some assets may go up in value, but then liabilities also go up in value and so forth, so they kind of balance out. So those ideas that the Keynesian or the macro system will kind of be rescued by the operation of the Pigou effect, the idea that, well, if there's unemployment, then prices will begin to fall, the real value of the money stock will rise, and then eventually we'll get back, would, again, hopefully have been avoided if that endogenous money had been set in terms of the general theory. Now, I think the other part, which is linked to some extent with the Pigou effect, which is, and this is very much in looking back with all the benefits of hindsight and so on, but I take it that, again, one of the features of endogenous money is that the stock of money is demand determined, in the sense that money will may be produced by the banking system, but the amount of money has to be held by somebody somewhere, and if people are unwilling to hold money or hold more money than they want to hold, then they will get rid of it, and some of the getting rid of it will be by paying off loans and extinguishing money and so forth. So I think one of the other implications of the stock of treating money as endogenous is that the stock is demand determined, and consequently the stock of money in real terms can only be changed if people want to hold a different stock of money in real terms. But again, the change in the real stock of money would depend upon demand decisions by firms and households in terms of how much money they want to hold. So all those ideas which are associated with, oh, the stock of money has changed in real terms, people hold more money than they want to, therefore they're going to rush out and spend it, all those sort of ideas, in a sense, go out of the window in that with endogenous money, the amount which is eventually in existence depends upon people's willingness to hold it. And in a sense, this is the argument which Basil Moore and others have put, that there's no sense in which there's excess supply of money. I will put it a little bit differently, but there is this idea that the amount, the stock of money which is around, has eventually to be held by somebody. And if people hold more than they want, then they will, somebody somewhere will pay off loans, and that will extinguish money. So all of that analysis, which is based upon, not necessarily in Keynes, but in the sort of Keynesian and then in the monetarist sort of framework, which relies upon the Pigou effect, relies upon the real value of the money stock changing when the price level changes, would not follow through in terms of if money had been treated as endogenously. So again, without saying whether or not in the context of the general theory Keynes had to or didn't have to assume endogenous money, I think in terms of the way that theory was later used or interpreted, some of the problems which we got into would have been avoided if endogenous money had been assumed from the start. Now this, in terms of the about the stock of money, I picked up this quote to the effect that a flexible wage policy and a flexible money policy come analytically to the same thing, inasmuch as the alternative means of changing the quantity of money in terms of wage units. And then in other respects, of course, there's a world of difference between them, which was that it's a great deal easier to increase the money supply than it is to reduce wages, in effect. And then there's also the expectational effects which kick in terms of if wages are cut, then expectations of further cuts and helps to create some form of deflationary pressures. But if one's concerned about changing the quantity of money in terms of the wage units, then in an exogenous money world, one can think of that happening. And it clearly can come about either by changing wages, or changing the money stock, or changing wages. In the context of endogenous money, then, in a sense, you can only bring it about if people want to hold a different amount of money. So these sort of arguments about the central importance of the quantity of money relative to wage units, again, doesn't follow through, I think, if one assumes endogenous money. Now, one of the areas which I still puzzle over is how endogenous money, or how the idea of endogenous money would interact with what I here put down the working of liquidity preference. And I'll put it as a kind of puzzle for the moment, because I'm still not fully convinced that what I'm going to say is right, which is the following idea, that again, if there's endogenous credit money, then money is being continuously created and continuously destroyed. It's being continuously created when banks grant loans, it's being continuously destroyed when people pay off loans. So if there is an increase in the requirement to hold money, so in the sense of there's an increase in liquidity preference, then the mechanisms that could work through is, in effect, well, less people pay off loans than would have been the case otherwise, so that more money remains in existence. So the way in which liquidity preference in terms of holding money is then satisfied is through more money remaining in existence. One of the snags with that sort of argument is, well, why would anybody want to hold more money if that means they're not now paying off loans? Because after all, loans bear an interest rate on them, so you'd think, well, people would want to pay off their loans because that's costing them the rate of interest. But insofar as there is a increase in liquidity preference in the sense of people wishing to hold more money, then presumably it means that some people will want to have this situation where they hold both loans and money, because money is immediate liquidity. If they paid off their loans, then whilst they would save the interest rate on it, they would be in a less liquid situation. So the argument I want to put, and I have to say I haven't worked this out very much, is the idea that one of the problems of assuming endogenous money in the context of Keynes' general theory is that the way the liquidity preference would work would be very different from the way in which it was analysed in the general theory. And if one thinks of liquidity preference as being fairly central, and the way it operates being fairly central to the general theory, it has that considerable difficulty. Okay, I'm halfway between 40 minutes and 50 minutes, so I think I shall basically stop there. The two concluding comments is the structure of competition is not a cause of unemployment, but assuming imperfect competition would make unemployment and the workings of the macroeconomy kind of in some sense easier to analyse, and that endogenous money should be seen as playing a crucial part of exploring the role of effective demand, and that if endogenous money rather than exogenous money or given money had been assumed, then some of the problems which arose after the general theory might have been avoided.
Well, if nobody is absolutely bursting to ask a question, I would like to make a few comments by way of as a discussant.
Yeah, yes.
Thank you. Most kind. I was a little anxious whether I would be complimenting or contradicting Malcolm, which the latter is a very dangerous thing to do. I think, on the whole, I think I'm complimenting what he has said, but you will have to judge. I want to explain briefly why I think perfect competition was a necessary assumption of the general theory. Not simply a compatible assumption, which is what most post-Keynesian economists have held, but I think a strictly necessary assumption. And my starting point is what Malcolm referred to as a spurious argument, that Keynes was committed to the Marshallian theory of value, and that in extending his analysis to industry as a whole, creating macroeconomics, his intention was not to abandon, but to perfect that theory of value. And one of the characteristics of that theory is that supply price is related to marginal prime cost by physical conditions, by the short period production function at a point in time, so that expected price equals expected marginal cost. Marginal cost need not equal average cost, and I'll come back to that. But I think actually Malcolm and I agree that the general theory does not invoke a markup over marginal cost. But I think what Keynes was trying to deal with was Schraffer's critique. The Marshallian supply curves of individual industries and firms are no more independent of the volume of aggregate output and employment than are the individual industry demand curves. And this was precisely Schraffer's point that he made in 1926. Schraffer insisted that diminishing returns to a factor, which is the mainspring of the theory of value, could only properly be assumed in the case where an industry employs the whole of a factor, as Ricardo could reasonably do in the case of agriculture and land. And in my view, Keynes answers Schraffer's critique by recognising that this requirement necessarily holds for the case of industry as a whole for the aggregate economy. Therefore, Keynes's microeconomics is top-down, running from the aggregate supply function of industry as a whole to those of individual industries and indeed firms. Truly macro-founded micro. And the key concept here is Keynes's employment function, which is in chapter 20 of the general theory. The employment function, which is different from both the aggregate supply function and the aggregate demand function, it combines both the pattern of demand and the physical conditions of supply. So that it relates aggregate effective demand to both aggregate employment and employment in each industry or firm. But if you're going to do that, a necessary condition of constructing a physical short period aggregate supply function for industry as a whole is that you have to abstract from the distribution of the existing capital assets between individual industries and firms. And I think any reader of the general theory will be struck by its abstraction from financial and industrial structure. Corporations and banks are certainly mentioned, but they don't play a central role in the argument. Capital assets are valued as though each were individually quoted on the stock exchange. And their value is therefore independent of their situation in a particular firm or occupation. Such an abstraction requires that capital goods move without cost or delay to whichever entrepreneur puts the highest value on them. And that is the assumption of perfect competition. And the division of effective demand between industries and individual firms then becomes endogenous to the system. So what about the degree of competition that Keynes mentions on page 245? I think the first point to grasp here is that Keynes's degree of competition is not the same thing as Lerner's degree of monopoly or markup over marginal cost. Kolesky's degree of monopoly or markup over average cost is nearer to Keynes's meaning, but I still think not quite the same thing, for reasons that will become clear, I hope. What Keynes calls the degree of competition refers to the conditions of supply, rather than to the slope of the demand curve faced by an individual firm. Malcolm actually once quoted Joan Robinson as writing that Keynes did not accept the perfect competition of the textbooks, but some vague, old-fashioned notion of competition that he never formulated explicitly. And taking her slightly barbed words with a pinch of salt, Keynes's given degree of competition refers to competition between entrepreneurs and workers, and in particular, to the obstacles to the free movement of resources, both capital goods and labour, into and between industries and occupations, associated mainly with what Keynes calls closed shops of either employers or workers. And this degree of competition may be understood by considering the difference between marginal and average cost in Marshallian theory. In the short period, this difference can exist because it takes time to produce the new capital goods necessary to compete away the high quasi-rents or super-profits on existing assets. And the long-period equilibrium is defined precisely by such an adjustment of the capital stock that marginal cost and average cost coincide. Keynes's closed shops, however, prevent this process of adjustment being completed, so that in particular industries, despite there being perfect competition between entrepreneurs for capital goods and labour, there is not free entry of new entrepreneurs or firms to set up in competition with the existing incumbents. And thus, a markup of price over average cost persists. But note that in contrast to Kaleski, Keynes does not take this markup itself as given, let alone uniform, but takes as given only the forces that prevent the markup being eliminated, and which may themselves not be impervious to competition in the long term, as opposed to the long period, of which more another time. But what one cannot infer from the degree of competition is a markup over marginal cost based on monopolistic competition. Joan Robinson's approach is essentially partial or microeconomic and takes as given the demand curve for an industry or individual firm. Yet Keynes is explicit in his derivation of the employment function that this assumption of exogenous demand is precisely what one cannot make in a macroeconomic theory. It seems to me that Keynes recognised that an aggregate theory can be based on imperfect competition only if you're prepared to follow Kaleski and Marx and take the markup or markups as exogenous, given outside the system. And of course, many post-Keynesians have done just that. But I would say, at the cost of abandoning Keynes's claim to offer a fundamental critique of the full employment theory of value, of classical competitive equilibrium analysis, on its own terms. A final reason for the assumption of perfect competition in the general theory relates to the state of expectation. And Kaleski doesn't dwell on expectation, while Keynes consistently refers to the state of expectation. But I haven't time to develop this point. But I would argue that one can only posit a shared state of expectation common to all entrepreneurs, meaning the set of expected prices — that's what an expectation is in Marshall — the set of expected prices embodied in effective demand. One can only posit that on the assumption of perfect competition. So let me move on briefly, leaving some time for you, to the question of endogenous money. I think it's an easier question to answer. We shall see. The point seems to be endogenous or exogenous for whom? The quantity of money is a function of the terms on which A, reserves are made available by the central bank, B, the attitude of the banking system towards reserve ratios, which partly depends on the state of confidence, and C, the demand for bank loans, which in turn depends on the short-term rates of interest at which banks lend. And this composite function may be regarded as what Keynes calls the state of banking policy. The quantity of money may be endogenous to the banking system insofar as the banks may decide the volume of their lending after taking into account the price at which they can borrow reserves from the central bank. Yet it remains under the control of the banking system, as distinct from the central bank, and not of the entrepreneurs who apply for bank loans. The quantity of money remains independent of the employment decisions of entrepreneurs, even if the quantity of money can be altered by the financial decisions of the banking system. And it's this independence that is all that Keynes assumes. Individual entrepreneurs may be able to create money by drawing on an overdraft facility, but only because the banking system allows them to do so. The total level of bank loans and overdraft facilities will be determined not by the entrepreneurs, but by the banking system. If total lending to entrepreneurs is rising, perhaps through the famous finance motive, the banking system can sell other assets, notably government bills and bonds, to the household sector, and maintain the total quantity of its liabilities and deposits, the bank money, at any chosen level. But of course, the price at which it will make loans or buy bills will vary with the state of the banking system's liquidity preference and the attitude of the central bank. And I think Keynes, well, this was summed up in a quote that Keynes made in the course of the loanable funds controversy from Dr. Herbert Babb. Never heard of him again, but he said that one could regard the rate of interest, meaning, of course, and this may be a key point, the long rate, the rate on long-term bonds, as being determined by the interplay of the terms on which the public desires to become more or less liquid and those on which the banking system is ready to become more or less unliquid. And I think that makes the point exactly. Liquidity preference remains relevant to the extent that long-term capital goods have to be financed directly or indirectly by individuals, corporations, and institutions other than banks. If all capital goods could be financed entirely by bank loans, the problem of liquidity preference would not arise. But even if banks may until recently have thought that they could finance anything, events have made it clear otherwise. So, these are my comments. So now it's your turn.